Hello, everyone. It is an absolute pleasure to meet with you on this platform for a very important conversation as we look ahead to the G20 summit, which South Africa is hosting, by the way. It will be hosted in South Africa, with Johannesburg being the center of the Heads of State Summit that's happening in November. And I think it's a very important moment, not just for South Africa, but for Africa as a whole. The global economy is in turmoil. Trade relations have just been upended in a significant way by the coming in of Donald Trump. Now that we are a few months down the line, what does it all mean for our economic trajectory and our trade relationships? Let me remind you, this podcast is brought to you through a special collaboration between Standard Bank and Arena Holdings, publishers of the Sunday Times as Business and Business Day, and me, Ridi Tlhabi, to bring you fresh thinking and leading voices on the issues that shape our continent's future. So today, we are focusing on something that is at the heart of our prosperity and resilience, but it is also at the heart of this polarization, this political divisions in different parts and segments of our society. But we need to understand in South Africa, as we get caught up in our own narratives and our own domestic issues, there is a continent to think of. There is the global world to think of. So any cheap politicking on the domestic front, that is a very insular approach to what is truly a big sector that has so much promise and that has contributed so much to the economic growth of the African continent. And that also links us to other parts of the world, because the food that we produce, we feed other nations that way. So African agriculture and how we can unlock its full potential and journey. So our topic today is from farm to global. Now, here's someone that is a familiar face and familiar voice, and we all admire. You know, when he talks about land and agriculture, he makes you want to be a farmer, the way he is so excited about it. Wandile Sihlobo is one of Africa's leading agricultural economists and advisor to the South African government. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Ridi, and for the kind words. And I think you're right on the topic of today, especially having it from a South Africa side and thinking also about the global, but most importantly, the region. Because I think I'm not always sure if we, as you put it, we reflect a lot about the continent and what can be done there beyond just the exports and all of those things. Yeah.
Before we get into that, though, I do want to tap into your profession, because this is not just your profession as an agricultural economist. You seem to come with a particular passion for agriculture and the economy. I wonder, tell us a little bit about your background. You grew up in the Eastern Cape, as far as I recall. Did that shape your career trajectory and your passion for agriculture?
No, I wouldn't even say really. I think it shaped the perspective at which one thinks about agriculture. Because, I mean, when you're growing up in the Eastern Cape at the times that we were in early 2000s, much of the conversation were about how do we get as many young black kids to get into accounting as he can. And, I mean, we used to have these career of SAICA, which is the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. They would go with these scholarships going to various high schools. So we all went to university thinking about that. But of course, then I started at the university at the time where there was also a conversation about global food crisis. This is around 2008 going on at university. And that's where the conversation was heating up. It was getting interesting. And there was a lot of talk about land grabs in Africa. But the story and the narrative about that was very appealing, which is in part, amongst other things, what moved me from accounting to get into a BSc in agricultural economics and economics. And that's what I ended up starting off with, and then proceeded to advance education on that. But I think the aspect of the Eastern Cape shapes one, I mean, in two aspects. You are in a province that was previously two provinces. There's a former Transkei, which is a smallholder, very rural, not much of the infrastructure as the other regions of the province that were part of the Union of South Africa, where you find large-scale farming and the infrastructure. And as you then proceed with the career and you started this subject, I think it informs you about how to operate in a way, at least that's what I attempt to do on both sides, which is why I always think the South African agriculture is a country of two agricultures. When we want to feel good about ourselves, we say, yeah, look at our agriculture. It's not the same as what you see in Zimbabwe or in Ghana. Look at us and look at Australia. Then we'll have the same conversation. But you do find the agriculture that is like that. But you also do find another side of agriculture that is similar to what you will see in the outskirts of in Kenya or in any other African country. So I think for me, the exposure then of that and that grounding of the Eastern Cape being a province that had a stark contrast of that when you think about the rural side of it. And at least I would see that as one of the things that that does influence my perspective of looking at agriculture.
Let's just debunk then those stereotypes. A young black guy passionate about agriculture. And I love how you created that binary between what we perceive to be agriculture in the Western ways and how we align with it in South Africa versus how it plays out in Zimbabwe. And yet, when it plays out in African countries, I do a lot of these global debates and conversations. I've met women farmers from Ghana, from Zambia, from Nigeria. They are feeding their economies. They are getting support from multilateral institutions to innovate, to modernize their outputs. And so it feels like it's a self-defeating binary in South Africa to say there's a type of agriculture that we are a part of that is more Western and a part of agriculture that is a little bit more rural and more African. The fact of the matter is that food insecurity is a reality. Our economies are struggling in so many ways. And I think you personify that kind of subversion of the stereotype. How would you encourage South Africans and Africans largely to think about agriculture first as a source of economic growth and not just food, as a source of entrepreneurial activity and as a tool to put their economies on the global map?
Yeah, I would say really, although at the start, one, of course, you are practicing in this field, you never really have a fully formed way of about how to think about agriculture and development in a broader perspective. But I think over the years, what became clear was that we are a country that faces, three major problems that most South Africans are aware of. It's high unemployment, it's poverty, as well as low growth. The question then is always to say, what can we do in each sector of the economy to resolve that triple challenge of South Africa? But that triple challenge of South Africa also intensified depending on which region of the country you are looking at. Limpopo, Eastern Cape, you find that when you think about poverty and unemployment, those are the provinces that are actually at the heart of major problems. And I think then the thinking on agriculture as well as the gains that it could bring is towards resolving those particular problems, which is why then the story of saying, how do we improve agricultural productivity? And can we be able to take what usually was the former Transkei, there's certain regions of Limpopo that have low productivity, to get them to be at the right place where they are producing a higher output. If we can do that, then we begin to have some of the lessons that we can replicate in a number of the African countries to be able to do something on that. But equally, it doesn't mean that there's nothing happening in these communities. I mean, myself and Professor Johan Kirsten, a few months ago, at the start of June, we published this article that was talking about how many black farmers are in South Africa, because we had heard when there was a conversation between South Africa and the US, especially in the White House, there were all of these thinking that there aren't that many black farmers in South Africa. The people that are farming are white farmers. But in numbers terms, yes, in the output is white farmers because of the land dynamics and the politics of the country, some stuff that we can talk about.
And the investment into their farmers, into their farms historically. And
absolutely. Absolutely. But there are a large mass of black people that are actually involved in agriculture, but constrained on the investment side, on the land infrastructure and all of those things. But those people, they play an important role when we are thinking about the household food insecurity now, to the point that you were mentioning earlier, to say on a household level, they have a significant role that they play. And the large-scale farmers, they have a role that they play also on making sure the cities and the other areas do have the food supplies that we need, but also for the export markets that we're reaching. So you almost need every typology of farmer, from a large-scale industrial, medium-scale, and a smallholder, because they play a certain role. What though I always caution about is that let's not prescribe what should be pursued, but rather this allow the environment and provide the sufficient support for all of these typologies to thrive, because each play an important role both for development and food security.
I know that you speak a lot, you write a lot about the state of land, that kind of landscape analysis. And one of the things I read that you'd written was how Africa holds about 60% of the world's uncultivated arable land. Yet we are still net importers of food. Why is that our reality in 2025? What needs to shift and shift quite urgently?
I think really my proposition, which is really the center of one of the points that I was so delighted that we got to sit down and have this conversation, is always around of saying, okay, what can we do to ensure that agriculture plays an important role in improving the economies of the African continent? Oftentimes in these conversations I had, we say, okay, let's go learn from the Netherlands, let's go learn from Canada and the other countries, which is an important thing, we can do that. But there are also other lessons that we can take from South Africa about what the other side of agriculture in South Africa can do, as well as the broader African continent. Because the numbers you quote in the statement you make is correct, in a sense that each year the African continent spend just over $80 billion importing food into the continent. If you take away the Maghreb region, you focus on the sub-Saharan Africa region, we spend over $45 billion importing food into the continent. And I think for me, we can turn that around, because the reason things are that way is not so much that there isn't land, there isn't willingness. I think there's about six or so things that we can perhaps maybe even learn from South Africa. The first one is a reality that there's a low investment in a number of African countries' agriculture. And I think the hindering point there really is actually the African political leaders, that they themselves need to reevaluate some of the policies and the thinking that they are having. The first starting point, I would say, in terms of land tenure, with the exception of South Africa and a few other countries in the sub-Saharan Africa region, you find that roughly 90% of the rural land in Africa is actually not formalized and there's no title deeds. So when we are thinking about the long-term investments in the sector where the land rights are just informal in that way, there is no serious amount of money that can go in for the long-term investments. And this, by the way, is what separates South Africa's agriculture relative to its former homelands and also the greater African continent. Because in South Africa, we've had what we call land reform. And of course, it has its three branches, land restitution, redistribution. But another point, leg of land reform that nobody really talks about, which is land tenure, which was about strengthening people's rights into land, where I would say as a country, we failed dismally in a great part there, because many black households in South Africa have not had title deeds. Even in their former homelands, we have not dealt about how to strengthen people's rights in that. And that kills investments, in my view. And then the other aspect is around the public infrastructure, which is usually useful when we are thinking about value chains, to the point you said in your introduction that from farm to fork to global. And that then will mean that the public infrastructure that is needed, either on ports or roads or railway line, is something that we have to think about. How do we invest and attract investment to get into that? And those two are the government side. And I'll just maybe add one little one, which is a third point, which also deals with the government side, really, which is that I know that we all have different views about genetics, science, seeds, genetically modified crops, and all of these things. But the reality is that we are dealing with an environment where climate change is a present day challenge in this moment. Then the key idea then is about how do you adapt and still produce food in an environment of the climate change crisis. The only way, at least what I have learned, is utilizing science to adapt to this. And that means then embracing certain seed varieties, embracing certain type of production methods, which is what South Africa we have done. And in the continent is something that I would say, let's do. But you find that it's not the entrepreneurs in the continent that don't want to do that. It's the governments that say, we don't want certain seeds and all of that. And most people in government are not even farming or producing the stuff. So they should
be. But what's informing that? Because that's fascinating for me. What's informing that? Because we just know in the 21st century, you cannot ignore technology and innovation, from precision farming to satellite data and transforming agriculture globally. And again, just going to the global space, there was an event that I moderated for the United Nations, and these African farmers, these women farmers, were being supported using these kind of, I was so fascinated sitting there thinking, geez, you can marry seeds, crops and technology and produce something that is sustainable, that is durable, that is cost effective, and so on. What is this reluctance, as it were? Is it fear for health and standards? What is it?
I think then really think about those women farmers at the UN event that you were in. If you had given them title deeds or long-term leases in that land, and you gave them sizable pieces of land, because they have the skill, they know how to manage the stuff, and then you back them with blended finance to actually take off on that side and be able to bring the machinery. Regardless if they are in Uganda, they are in Benin, Nigeria, Lesotho, they will be way far than what they currently have at this moment. And secondly, you allow them to tap into whatever genetics that other countries have approved and they are available for commercial use. Mm-hmm. Because then you can start saying they get more yields out of whatever area that they are producing in there. What in my view leads to the blockages of science, and I'm threading now on a conspiracy line here, but I do think that it's a lot of the EU related funding that are coming into some of the African NGOs, and they get up to be the ones that are espousing these ideas. Because if you look at who are the activists and the people that are against technological adoption in the African continent, it's usually the foreign funded institutions that actually inform the policy or dominate the debate to actually get the things to be where they are. In South Africa, I mean, we have had peripherally some of these, but I think what assisted was the fact that there was already enough critical mass domestically, which was of the view that we are moving towards this particular line. But it can't be the issue of safety, healthy or anything, because you have South Africa, you have South Americans, you have Canada, the US, China and many others already utilizing a certain varieties of seeds. Then you are telling farmers in Nigeria to compete with the South African and the Chinese farmers that have a certain type of technologies. They will never be able to get those productivity gains and participate in the same way in the international market. And I think at the heart of it, you starve the local people, because now you are taking away the affordable food that they could be getting and ensure that they are progressing. And the last thing here already, it ends up on this. We are worried about climate change. When we are worried about climate change, we don't want to be going around tilling every piece of land and making it a farm like what happens in Amazon. But then if you are not going to till every piece of land, you have to get more out of the small area that you are farming. Now you have a situation whereby in Africa, much of the increase in grain production in a period between year 2000 all the way to 2020, with the exception of South Africa and Zambia, the increase in grain production was due to an expansion in area planting rather than the improvements in yields, which means people were cutting off forests and opening up certain lands that they shouldn't so that they can get just an extra tonnage of grain. But had we embraced technology, you would then still maintain forestry and the diversity around and making sure that you just get more out of the small parcels of land that we farm. And I think we need to embrace that.
Okay, so that's touching on technology and innovation. And related to that, you've touched on that, the kind of challenges that are acting as barriers, stopping African farmers from participating more fully in regional and international markets. There are a lot of dynamics there. But I do want us to take responsibility as Africans, both as citizens and financiers. The weak regional market integration on the African continent is our responsibility. It's not Europe or the US that's responsible for that. I don't know. Inconsistent customs procedures, those can be a problem. And then you have financiers, banks, considering agriculture high risk and perhaps avoiding lending to smallholders. I know that it is a bit more complicated than that, but there are some regional barriers that we can tackle and address before we kind of go out into the big wide world. What are your thoughts around those regional issues.
No, I mean, really, you are right on that. And that's exactly the point you have to underscore over and over when you are in UN events and interacting with them. And I would say you are being too harsh on general people when you say we should take the responsibility. The political leaders must take a responsibility. Or maybe when we go for elections, we should be much more critical about how we vote on these things. I think that that's the thing that needs to happen. It's the political leaders that have to embrace this, because for me, it presents a number of risks, by the way. We are all now in Africa celebrating and saying, look, we have the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. We will move goods across this region, this continent of ours. Free trade, agriculture is part and parcel of the industries that will benefit on that. But the one aspect that we don't talk about is that you first have to have goods before you can trade. Right. And what will end up happening now is that as the tariffs are lowered and the non-tariff barriers will be resolved, and then even the border clearance is becoming much more better, even if over the coming years, the financiers and the others in the service industries smoothen the pathway for trade to continue. What you realize is that if in food and agriculture and beverages, other countries have not improved their productivity, you would have the likes of South Africa, Zambia, Tanzania being the ones that are dominating trade. And what that does, it leads to resentment. I mean, South Africa had recently an issue with Botswana and Namibia, who were saying, look, you are flooding all of our markets. We want to close our borders so that we can do something for ourselves, because we are tired of seeing South African thing everywhere we go. And as a South Africa, we have to acknowledge the fact that we benefit a lot from the continent. And in a way, it's crude to put it in this way. There are difficulties over the recent past. They've actually been in our advantage. Let me give you a quick example. Last year, 2024, we exported a record $13.7 billion of agricultural products. Almost $1.1 billion was to Zimbabwe, not rands, billion dollars. Mm-hmm. About half of our exports are to the African continent. Then you have Europe, 20%, and the others, and the others. But what that ends up in now, when we are having to import, because we also import a lot. We spend about $7 billion importing agriculture and food products. But much of those imports are coming from the Black Sea, Europe, the US, and elsewhere. You don't see much that is coming from the African continent. And it's not that South Africa is closed or not. We actually would welcome products from the continent. But it goes back to the point that you were saying, the issues of standards, the issues of quality they produce, but also the fact that most countries just don't have any volume. So for me, I would say the responsibility should be the African governments to say, how do they use technology? How do they attract investments and modernize things on their side so that there is an improvement in productivity before we get into the broad trade and the continental decisions? Because in that game that we are having now, you will have few winners relative to other. And then we will remain with the resentment that other countries seemingly have against others in the continent.
And I'm just thinking here about, you know, some of the low-hanging fruit, the spin-off that comes from dealing with some of the basic things. For example, poor infrastructure. It's not just agriculture that's going to benefit if we do, we improve that. I mean, weak transport networks, bad roads, unreliable rail. I mean, these will inevitably, Wandile, increase time and the cost of moving goods, right? And then you're thinking also, before you even play into the big wide world, the lack of cold storage, processing facilities. I mean, you'd lose your harvest if you don't have the supportive infrastructure, and it also reduces our competitiveness. So you're absolutely right to point to those basic things. You touched on this, on climate change no longer, you know, being a reality every single day. The planetary crisis is not some distant concept or some theory. It is right here. What inspires you? What can African countries do to build resilience into their food systems, and we can scale this up quickly? I mean, it's already happening, and I've found that local communities are far more knowledgeable about weather patterns and issues that threaten their well-being. What kind of conversations should we be having from that point of view?
I mean, really, we now have a very difficult dilemma that most African countries are having. Unlike in South Africa, where primary agriculture, without its value chain, accounts for about 3% of the GDP. Only when you begin considering the processing backward and forward linkages where you come closer to 10% of that. When you look at a number of countries in the continent, you have agriculture taking up double digit of the GDP on average. In fact, in sub-Saharan Africa region, it's just north of 20% being agriculture. Now, one who's pro-farmer can say, oh, that's a good thing. Agriculture makes part of large part of the economy and all of those things. But the problem with those economies that have agriculture taking that greater share of the economy is that very same fact that you are mentioning now, that where there is a drought, there's literally a recession in a country. I mean, we've seen last year, 2024, where Zambia lost half of their maize crop just because of the heat stress in less than 20 days, which puts the entire economy now in a back footing. And there are many more other countries that continue to experience these dilemmas, which then for me, I would say the conversation we should be having, especially in a year of a G20 like now, should be saying in the food security work stream, which is part of the G20 focus areas, what conversation can we have with the likes of China, which I know that they've done a lot more work in thinking about climate smart agricultural practices, the EU, the US and the others, and then coming up with ways where we can say, look, these are the production methods that we should be all following. But beyond that, what can each African government do to ensure that there is then private funds that will flow into that country to assist the farmers so that they commercialize and they get to be somewhere? Because at the end of the day, it's not only about the production, it's also about the jobs that could come from agriculture and agro-processing. In South Africa, we have just under 1 million people that are in agriculture and another 350,000 people that are in the value chain. We want to see numbers like that happening in Kenya, in Ghana, in Gambia, and the other countries, because at the end of the day, their buying power increases. Then we can sell our high quality steak and the others and buy other things from themselves. That's what we essentially want to do. So it will take then coping with climate change, dealing with food insecurity, as well as joblessness. It's really a rhythm of a conversation that must be a policymaker's role, but also these international and the global forums prioritizing certain themes so that they become norm of the conversation. And thereafter, hoping then that investments would flow in on that. And then the farmers would practice and do what they can. And the last thing here, Reddy, that I think it's important, I think there's certain exchange programs. I have started seeing a number of South African farmers that go to Ghana and the others. They go to learn and they go to also share expertise. We must figure out a way of how do we do such things, especially when you have some of the South African financial industries that are practicing or having operations across the continent, utilizing and leveraging to their relationship to learn and also share skills with other countries.
All right. Okay. So I talked about the G20 summit, the G20 itself, very briefly. Again, just very briefly, does this presidency hold some promise? How can we use the occasion of the G20 to add impetus to these themes that we have been talking about?
I think on the themes that we are talking about, South Africa is heading in the right direction. I mean, one conversation that I'm starting to hear coming up more in food security is saying achieving food security through trade, which then speaks against this idea that there are other countries that are blocking and putting tariffs and others in Africa putting non-tariff barriers or saying, guys, let's open up and have a better path on that. The second aspect is the continuation of a climate smart agriculture and adaptation, which is something that I think it's important to have. But I do think that South Africa can utilize also this theme of today and say, look, let's raise the idea of an embrace of science and better genetical techniques to improving agricultural productivity. And not necessarily that will change anybody's policy on that because of the G20, but the G20 offers the platform to elevate certain themes to be part and parcel of the global discussion. And you have other policymakers being in a position where they can listen if certain themes are either coming from G20, coming from the UN. And I think all of these international bodies are responsible, at least, for raising or elevating some of those themes that could be for the benefit of a number of people. And this time around, I think South Africa does have a unique opportunity to presenting the South Africa, the Africa story, but also themes that will resonate and be helpful to the African continent.
Are you optimistic?
I am very optimistic. And I still, by the way, sit in agriculture and talk about these things because I'm still a huge believer of saying, if we can achieve something here and the farming sector takes off, the processing takes off, then you begin to have people that are in finance and services and technology. And then over time, they will move more and get to manufacturing. Development will still happen. But there's very few countries that can actually develop and do well without having really mastered agriculture, those that have the possibility and environment that permits them to do so. And I think as the African continent, I mean, we have the resource, so we only have to be optimistic and keep at it.
Okay, and that youth dividend, of course, you know,
absolutely,
we have that kind of advantage that we can leverage as well. Well, that's it from farm to global markets. I really loved hanging out with you, Andile Sihlobo, agricultural economist and government advisor. He's a podcaster himself. He's a writer. I'm going to give you a plug. Where do people find your podcast?
They'll find the podcast under my name, actually.
Yeah.
AgriView with Wandile or just Wandile Slobo. They'll find it. Thank you so very much, Rick.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, for all of you, for listening in. It's been such a joy. This podcast proudly brought to you by Standard Bank. It can be. And Arena Holdings, publishers of the Sunday Times and Business Day. If you enjoyed this conversation, I'd like you to please share it, subscribe, and stay tuned for more insightful discussions that move Africa forward. Thank you very much.